Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. Welcome to our special trucking edition of Homefront. On today's show, we're going to answer many of the questions you may have been wondering about concerning truck drivers and the trucking industry, but you never knew who to ask. We talk about the myriad of new regulations and how they impact how our goods get from point A to point B.
I'm an American, red, white, and blue, and I'm a citizen of this world and of heaven. Some things were meant to be together. I believe in faith and freedom, got a country too. I believe with faith and freedom, we're gonna make it through.
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we have Tom Martz. Tom is from Springfield and is one of the founders of the Lock and Smith Foundation. He comes to us today to discuss what's happening in the truck driving industry. So welcome, Tom.
Good evening. How is everybody?
We're doing great. I just want to start by telling you a little bit of my story of where I come to my understanding of the truck driving industry. My husband and I were in high school, and he really enjoyed singing this one song to me called the Truck Driver's Queen. And I'd never heard of it, but I knew he loved me so much that whenever he sings Truck Driver's Queen, it's like the most sincere compliment he could give me. We met when we were 16, so we had time to think about what do you want to be when you grow up. And he said, well, I've got three ideas. I can either be a printer or a truck driver or a farmer. And I said, well, you can't be a farmer because you don't have a farm and you don't have any money. And you can't be a truck driver because I would never marry a truck driver because they make lousy husbands and fathers. So we settled on him being a printer. Well, that worked fine until we got married and the second child was like 3 months away from being born, and he came home from work one day and he said, Cynthia, I am burned out on printing. I'm going to become a truck driver. So that's how it happened for me. So he took a job doing local deliveries, and I didn't like it at all because it was very irregular hours. But then he had an opportunity to make even more money if he would start driving over the road. So we moved here to Missouri, and he took this job, and he told me he might be gone one or two nights a week. And it turns out he might be home one or two nights a week, and I was not too happy. But what are you going to do when you're 5 years now into a marriage? So I said, well, you know, I did. I prayed for him, and it was a really rough time, but he was happy. He loved it more than anything. It was rough on me, but great for him. So as we got older, we did discuss truck driving rules and how the laws play out and how it affects him, because the laws don't just affect him, the laws affect the entire family. So if a truck driving company lets a wife come along on a trip, then you can actually have some fun with it. But if they have a policy, no passengers allowed, then you can't. And so in my misery, I did the ultimate weapon against the problem, and that was I started praying for him. And I prayed for him incessantly, and God got a hold of him, and in a great and mighty way, and he had a radical change in his understanding of life, got right with God, everything changed. And then he had a serious conflict in his conscience, and he said, I am going to have to call my boss and tell him I can't cheat on my logbooks anymore. And even back then, and I'm talking about the 1980s, he was expected to do a little manipulation. And he didn't really cheat on his logbooks. He just kept two logbooks. And it didn't matter which one the MoDOT or the Department of Transportation looked at. As long as they didn't see both logbooks at the same time, everything was fine. But that was a real crisis for him. Let me just tell you, back in the 1980s, the truck driver was expected to write the odometer number in his logbook as he crossed each state line. And I'm like, well, how'd you do that? And, well, you grab the logbook and you write it down. I'm like, well, did you guys have to pull over?
that is the way that the trucking companies were able to keep track of the fuel reconciliations for each state that they went through.
Well, today,
which is now done by IFTA and GPS.
Okay, well, I want you to tell us how the truck driving industry has changed since the 1980s until where we are today.
Well, a little background. I grew up in the industry. My stepfather hauled construction equipment for a company called Keene Transport in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So he was always doing the wide loads, permit loads, escorted loads. You could only run from 7 until 5, or you could only run from 8 until 4, or you could only run from sun up or sun down. It all depended on which direction the permit allowed you to go. And you were routed based on what was the best route for you to get in and out and across the state or to wherever it was that you were going. The hours of service rules have always been in effect. Now, I always loose-leafed logged. That allowed me to, you can say I manipulated my log, but I manipulated my log in a manner that benefited me to allow me to be able to, if I sat in traffic for 3 hours, I did not show that I sat in traffic for 3 hours. It's a huge waste of time. And at one point in time, I had my wife, and this is how we got out of California. When my wife said it was time to leave the state of California, I hit my knees and said, thank God you exist. But the only way that we could get out was through my CDL. So I was able to find a company. At the time, it was Dick Simon Transport out of West Valley City, Utah, that allowed me to put not only her, but my two young sons in the truck with us. And we went trucking and home educating at the same time.
And that's great, because that's why you're able to think clearly today and you kept your family together. There is a huge hardship on the family. So tell me, you were in what part of California?
We were in Northern California. She grew up, she was born and raised in Concord, California, which is 35 miles northeast of San Francisco.
Okay, so,
and we met because of my going to the service, and my roommate was a friend of hers, and he brought me back to California on leave while we were both stationed in Korea. And we ended up doing a pen pal thing back and forth. And I did a pen pal thing back and forth with her mom and dad. And when I got out of the service, they invited me out. And the rest is history. I'm still married to that same woman today. We have a 30-year-old son, soon to be 31. We have a 28-year-old son, soon to be 29. They were both home educated the whole way through, except for a couple years where we decided we were going to put them into a public school system when we moved here in Missouri, because A, we were told it was a really good school system, come to find out that they were excelled compared to where the schools were. So they were having to relearn everything. And I don't know about your kids, but if you continue to try to teach them something that they've already learned, they get bored, they get in trouble. And lo and behold, the next thing you know, you're being called down to the principal's office. So we put them back into home education where they graduated. They both have college degrees. They're both out on their own. So it was quite beneficial. The fact that they were small, the fact that I was allowed to take them in the truck with me, it allowed them to see things that most kids who are born and raised in this country will never see, like the Grand Canyon, you know, Mount Rushmore. We've been in and out of every single state in the union except for Hawaii and Alaska. So it was very beneficial. My fleet manager knew that there were certain areas that once we got to, like Southern California, we were taking a day off. We were going to Disneyland. You know, these are the things that you can work out with your dispatchers and fleet managers if you push the issue. Hours of service, however, now, because of what is called an electronic logging device, is not as easy to manipulate as it was back when we were all doing paper logs. And I know people are going to say, well, you cheated the system. Well, you know, if you want your grocery products on your grocery store shelves in a timely manner when they're supposed to be there, the driver has to do what the driver needs to do in order to get your products delivered. And we've become a society, to be honest with you, that everything is trucked. Unless you live outside the meat packing plant, you're not getting your meat unless it's delivered by a truck. Same with the milk, same with the eggs, same with everything that you can think of.
Well, that's true. A couple years ago, we went to Southern California, and I looked out at Huntington Beach and was aghast, really, at all those huge, you can't even describe how big those ships are that come in with those shipping containers. And those shipping containers are all destined to end up on a truck and go somewhere in the rest of the country. And so, yes, there's no question that we need truck drivers. But truck drivers used to be called the cowboys of the highway. They used to be the ones who would create more safety. They would be the ones who you could trust. If you had a flat tire, a good-hearted truck driver would pull over and help you. Now the tone has changed so much today. There have been times, and I frequently come to the defense of the truck driver whenever people dispute things, because I feel sorry for them. They have a much heavier load. They have much more responsibility. And when cars cut in and out without giving them much space, I do feel like they're in a bad position, because nobody wants to be behind a truck. So instead, they do all these dangerous maneuvers to get in front of the truck. But some of my perspective has changed recently when I've seen some of the rudest drivers on the road be the truck driver. There have been times when I've had a truck driver following 10 feet behind me on the highway. And I'm thinking, buddy, what is wrong with you? The law of physics would dictate that the truck is going the exact same speed as me. He's not getting to his destination any quicker by riding that close to me. And yet I see this more often today than ever before. What are you seeing on the road?
Well, as somebody who's still on a good part-time basis, still drives truck, it absolutely infuriates me the percentage of drivers that I think have become the unprofessional. And you're right, it used to be a time where, you know, you had a flat tire in the road, a truck driver would stop, they would help you get it fixed, or they, you know, sometimes they would wait until an actual law enforcement officer arrived. you know, now with electronic logging devices, you don't dare do that because that eats into your time that you have available for your day to actually earn money. You've got trucking schools that are putting out people who are inadequately educated at best in order in the manner in which they drive a truck. And you also see people, in my opinion, who drive that 80,000 pound semi like it is their car. That is the essence of tailgating, because you can't go anywhere today. Driving through a residential neighborhood, if you stop at a stop sign and then you go through that stop sign and somebody came up behind you and stopped at that stop sign and came through it after you did, before you get down to the next stop sign, they're 3 feet off your back bumper. It's a residential neighborhood, for Pete's sakes. Where are you going to go and in what hurry are you in that you have to be 3 feet off my back bumper going through an area where there's possibility of kids playing, dogs running out in the street, cats running out in the street? You know, people just don't think about the law of physics and how long it takes an individual to stop a vehicle. And truck drivers have gotten to be the worst.
Yeah, it's almost like they think they're playing a video game. The only difference is on a video game, if you crash, the game's over and they start another game. And in real life, you could kill people. So anyway, I was appalled when I read the story about the Denver crash. The truck driver was on I-70 coming down out of the mountains. Did you follow that story at all?
I have been. I started following it when I heard that it happened. And as a person who has dropped down I-70 from the mountains and into Denver many, many times, that is not a stretch of highway to be playing with. That is not something that you don't lose your attention span and forget where you're at. And from the videos that I have seen of the people who were sitting in that traffic jam when that truck came flying by them, I don't see any smoke rolling off of that truck either. Now, I haven't been able to slow it down to watch it frame by frame by frame, but if you lose your brakes or you overheat your brakes, and I've done it out in Utah, they start smoking like crazy. And it gets harder and harder and harder for you to slow down that vehicle. Most semi-trucks have what's called an engine retarder in it. So as long as you start out in the proper gear as you're descending down a mountain or descending down a hill, if you have started at the proper speed, that engine retarder will do a great job of restricting your speed and from you building up speed. Some companies don't have them. There's also a thing in the truck called a Johnson bar. Johnson bar, you pull on it, it applies the brakes to the trailer and only the trailer. Some semi companies do not put that in there either. There's safety equipment that's available to the driver if it's installed in the truck. If it's not installed in the truck, well, then he doesn't have this safety equipment. And there's also the application of the training of the individual and how well he was trained in order to become a solo truck driver. I trained at one point in time. At one point in time, when I was at Dick Simon, I was a finishing trainer, which means the individual who was in my truck had already gone through a CDL school. He had gone through the first 6 weeks of training with one of our trainers. Then that individual came into my truck for an additional 6 weeks. Not only did I get to grade the trainee, I also got to grade the trainer who was training the trainee. And there are people who just should not train. They're incapable of operating their own vehicle, and they pass these bad traits on to the next generation to continue them to the next generation and the next generation of people who are going to be behind the wheels of these trucks. That's not the majority, but you know as well as I do, it's the minority who always get the focus on them because they are the most dangerous.
Well, are they trying to pass out the most number of truck drivers because there's a shortage of truck drivers?
See, I've in all my research, I'm gonna squash that theory. I do not believe that there is such thing as a driver shortage. There has never been a driver shortage that I'm aware of. There is a shortage of available freight. You can go across this country even today and you will find that there is trucks sitting there in that parking lot idling because they don't have a load to get anywhere. It's a quandary because you've got a lot of the loads coming from Southern California. You've got the produce in Southern California and in Central Valley of California. You've got the produce coming in and out of Texas and down on the border states. A lot of this freight goes up to the Northeast. Well, what comes out of the Northeast? Not a whole lot of nothing. So you've got a huge amount of trucks sitting up in the Northeast in Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York. There's no freight up there. So these guys are having to deadhead to states like Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, down into the Carolinas, down into Florida. And deadhead simply means that you're driving from point A to point B without a load. Company drivers get paid for that, because they're getting paid by the mile. Owner operators have to figure in the cost of that deadhead with the cost of the freight to see if it's enough for them to be able to make their truck payments, their fuel payments, their taxing payments in order to deadhead 300, 400, 500 miles in order to get a load.
So why do people think that there's a shortage of truck drivers?
That has been the rallying cry since I was a young child. I remember it back in the 70s and then in the 80s and then the 90s and then the 2000s. And these trucking companies just keep getting larger and larger and larger. Now, I won't say that there's a trucking shortage. What there is, I do believe, is a turnover problem in the trucking industry. There are some people who are not designed and are not capable of being a truck driver. And it's no fault of their own. There are some people who can't drive 200 miles in one sitting. You have to drive 500 as a truck driver, especially if you get an over-the-road, gig. Teams, some people can't sleep in the truck while it's driving down the road. I'm one of them. If that vehicle is moving, then it better be me behind the steering wheel, which made my 6 weeks as a driver trainer just absolutely miserable. So when I did get home to spend time with the wife and the kids before I threw them in the truck with me, I would sleep all weekend long. That was part of the reason that it was decided that they were coming into the truck with me. That way I didn't have to continue. I stayed awake for 10 hours while my student was driving, and I had to stay awake 10 hours while I was driving. And then that truck just continues to roll down the highway, and that does not make for a safe application of somebody behind the wheel.
I know what you're talking about, because my husband did have a partner, and they logged 26,000 miles in the month of February, a month with 28 days. So that gives you an idea. They were doing close to 1,000 miles a day. And that's what you can do with a team. But he could handle it. In fact, he used to call it chasing the white dotted line. Well, a special kind of person. You're right. It does take a special kind of person to enjoy the serenity of the road and just driving. What he liked most about it was he always got to his destination. There was a sense of accomplishment. And yet, there was a conflict even back then with union and non-union. I mean, he had some horrific moments when he worked for Old El Paso, which was owned by Pet Corporation that was non-union. And there were times he was told to deliver his load and he had to with police holding people back across the picket line, and it was extremely stressful. And there were times when the guys told him that they're not going to let him unload his own load, and he is going to have to pay them to do it. His company was not going to reimburse him. It was extortion, really, is what it is. It violates the sense of freedom of movement here in America. Nevertheless, Tom, I love your perspective because you understand. Now, in this particular story of what happened in Colorado, we had somebody who wasn't even an American citizen driving, who had a green card. And I thought the purpose of the green cards was to fill spots that take the jobs that Americans won't take. So how does stuff like this happen where we're having to take people from foreign countries? Somebody even said we're bringing in people from Africa to drive our trucks because it's considered low skill. Well, baloney, it's low skill. I've seen my husband pull a tractor trailer into a narrow opening with 2 inches of space on either side. That's high skill. There are very few people who can see space and can safely deliver the goods where they need to go and put it right in a precise manner. So why are we having to hire anybody with green cards? Are there not enough Americans who can drive trucks?
Well, for years and years and years now, the application is, you know, go to school, go to college and get educated and get a degree and come out with a higher paid job. And you've got, you know, you've got people who, and Mike Rowe is one of those people who have been discussing the declining trades application, where people are more and more going into practicing law. They're going in to be doctors. They're going in to be nurses. They're going in to be something professional. They get into the women's studies, men's studies, gender studies, this study, that study. You don't see people going in to being electricians or working on HVAC systems, or because they're not looked at as in a manner to be a beneficial way for you to earn an income. It's been looked down upon for years and years and years. And truck driving is probably one of the worst. I mean, you're right. Back in the 60s and 70s, they were looked at as the last American cowboy, because you could go from anywhere from point A to point B, and you were out on the road. Once you got your dispatch, once you got your load, you were on your own. So you didn't actually have a boss. You didn't have GPS systems tracking you. All you had was a pay phone, and you got to the other end, you called in and said, "Hey, I'm unloaded. Where do you want me to go now?" The trucking and technology has gotten to the point now that trucks are tracked from point A to point B. You can't go anywhere in that truck without you being tracked. And then you've got the application of, you know, and I'll name a few of them. You got companies like Prime and CTI and Schneider, JB Hunt. You know, they're constantly tracking these guys. So it takes a different kind of person who is willing to give up their own privacy and a little bit of their own freedom to do this job now. And it's to the point where if we can import people who, and I'm looking at a story right now where they set this guy's bond at $400,000. He was also ordered to surrender his passport if it was not destroyed in the collision. He's from Cuba. And he had a green card to work in the United States, of which, you know, it's sad, but there are rules and regulations which require an individual to be able to read and speak English in order to have a CDL.
So why did he have an interpreter?
Because there are rules and regulations which allow an individual to have an interpreter. Like when they're taking the test, I've watched it happen right down here in Springfield, where somebody was interpreting for another individual the test so they could take it. I mean, what good is a rule? What good is a regulation if it's not going to be enforced?
Well, who authorized that?
Well, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is the one who sets up all the guidelines for a CDL. Once you get a commercial driver's license, you're under the auspices pretty much of the federal government.
Well, I'd shut that thing down in a second, because that's the fact that you need an interpreter is proof that you don't speak English enough to take the test.
That is correct. And the application is one of these deals where the federal government hands down the rules and the guidelines, and then the states are the ones that implement them, because I don't have a United States of America driver's license. I have a state of Missouri driver's license. It just happens to have Class A on it, which means it's a commercial driver's license. And one of the applications I have seen through the passing of time is these trucking schools have got it worked out to where the courses that they train these people on are pretty much the same course that they're going to be tested on. So you get familiarity, you get the essence of where it is that you're going, you know when to stop, you know when to accelerate, because you've trained them within a confined box. And then you allow them, when the tester comes, the tester is going to take them in through the same areas that they have built up a comfort zone with, so it makes it easier for them to pass. Well, that's not what happens when you get out on the interstate. That's not what happens when you get into, you know, the truck to go out onto the interstate. You've got to, as an individual, this is something that you've, you know, within the first 2 weeks, you better make the decision of yes, I can do this, or no, I can't do this. Because you're right, when I was teaming up before the wife and kids were in the truck with me, my truck was averaging 1,000 miles a day. And when my student could not drive their 500, I would finish their 500, have them log it, and then I would log my 500 miles in my logbook. Is it illegal? Yes. Did I do it safely? Yes.
So why are the truck driving companies having trouble keeping their employees? Why is there so much turnover?
It is a thankless profession. And I'm going to lay some of this at the feet of the shippers, the receivers, the general population, and politicians. You've got cities that do not want you in their city, but yet they require you to come in there to deliver their goods. You've got places where you go and deliver who will tell you that after you've made your delivery, you cannot stay on their property. You've got states passing laws that you cannot stop on an on-ramp or an off-ramp on the shoulder, you know, up off the, you're off the highway, but you can't stop on the shoulder of the road. You've got states, we went out to California last December. The state of Nebraska has closed about 30 to 40% of the rest areas that they had along I-80. Where are these guys going to park?
Why are these
states
closing?
Well, they're going to say the budget. They're going to say it's a budget shortfall. But they need to figure out a way to reallocate their funds, because they're on any given day, I can't tell you how many trucks are driving up and down the interstate, but at about 6 o'clock in the evening, 7 o'clock in the evening, you are not going to find a parking space in a truck stop, period. It's just not going to happen.
Well, where are they supposed to park then if they're supposed to sleep?
Well, most recently there was an individual out in Emeryville, California, just north of Oakland, who was stopped on the shoulder of the highway because he ran out of hours. And a vehicle slammed into the back of him and it killed the passenger. That guy will probably be up on charges because he stopped his vehicle on the shoulder of the highway, which is illegal out in California. And California is one of the worst states. You get into that area of Oakland, Hayward, San Leandro, Redwood City, San Francisco, Richmond. You get into that whole greater Bay Area. There's nowhere for you to park. So, even if you found an industrial park, there's going to be signs up there that tell you that you're not allowed to park there.
Okay, so what's the proper response? Are the businesses supposed to provide motel rooms for the drivers when they run out of hours?
Well, no, trucks have sleepers on them. So you need to be able to find a place that is available for you to park legally, which will allow you to take your mandatory 10-hour break. And you've got policing agencies now that when, you know, the scale house is one of those places where you can pull off into a scale house that's closed and you can park around back.
So the question is, what are these truck drivers supposed to do? You're saying that they are supposed to pull off and park somewhere legal, but that the public has not provided enough public parking, so they're supposed to park on private parking lots. I have seen it in many Walmarts have played host to a lot of trucks, but I've always thought that was odd, because why should the private sector have to bear the brunt of it when they're not the ones actually playing host? Why are we asking private businesses to absorb the slack when they may not be anything and even related to the truck driver?
Well, here's what I would do. When I knew that where I was at, there was no possible way was I going to be able to find a parking place anywhere, we would go into like a Sam's Club or a Walmart Supercenter when we were on the road, and we would go in and do some shopping. And I would talk to the store manager and explain to them, look, I'm in here shopping. My truck is parked in your parking lot. I'm out of the way. Do you mind if I park there? Part of the problem is that in this industry, a large percentage of drivers just assume that where they park is good. It's not like they walk into the store or they walk into the facility or walk into wherever it's at to say, hey, do you guys mind if, I mean, I've done my shopping, I've eaten, I've got to take a 10-hour break and I'm parked out of the way. Do you mind if I park here? You know, granted, sometimes you're going to get that no, get your butt off our parking lot. But generally, if you go in and you spend some money in that facility, and Walmart is both good and bad at this, because the drivers themselves have made it so that Walmart has evicted truck parking simply because they trash the parking lot or they knock down light poles because they're not paying attention when they're driving around the parking lot. There are some Walmarts that are designed, like there's one out here in Neosho, Missouri, that it has designed truck parking. So when you go in there, it has a whole row, and I'm going to say it's probably about 30 to 40 parking places where you can park a semi. And Walmart knows it's twofold. It allows the person to park, and generally they know that individual is going to go into the store to buy something. But it should be like these industrial parks. The company that I drive for on a part-time basis, we're located at the industrial park out on the west side of town over by the airport, and there are no parking signs all over the place. But yet, when trucks come up to deliver where it is that I work, there's a big old cul-de-sac back there. It's empty. The whole road, there's only two buildings on it. Why can't they park there? Because if Springfield wanted to, they could go in and they could enforce the no parking ordinance. But you've got a guy who just drove 11 hours, because that's all you're allowed. He made it to his destination. He is required by law right now to take 10 hours off. Cops And I've been told this, cops have knocked on people's doors and said, you can't be here. You have to leave. Well, I'm only 3 hours into my 10-hour break. Well, I don't care. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, scale houses that are closed normally allow trucks to park in the scale house as long as they're not blocking the scale. They can park in back behind it, or they've got slotted areas for them to park at.
I'm going to make a comment about the ignorance of the legislators, because I'm sure the reason they made a law that you have to stop after 10 hours of driving is because they have this false notion that you'll be safer. But my husband told me there were many times when he was supposed to stop, he'd get into a sleeper and he could not sleep because he wasn't tired. The logbook said he's supposed to be tired, but bodies don't work like that. We don't have a switch inside of us that we can flick off and on. So when he would stop because he was required to stop, instead of sleeping, he would do other things, to read a book or something. And then he'd just be getting tired right when he's supposed to get up and go on again. And now you've got a driver driving when he's actually even more tired because he was forced to take a break when he didn't need a break. And then you've got another situation where we don't put the same rules on the private sector. I have a daughter in Washington, D.C., who decided to drive to see me this weekend. So she left Friday. Oh, she left Thursday at 1 p.m. and drove straight through from Washington, like 900 miles, all the way here. And guess what? She left this morning and she drove another 900 miles in one jaunt by herself because she has to be at work in the morning. Well, you don't see any police officers trying to say, no, you're not allowed to do that. That's illegal. Yet she's just as vulnerable, maybe more so. She would be more likely to have an accident over fatigue. It's proof that a person can drive that. Now, you don't want the employer to require them to do something superhuman, and I'm not recommending it, but I'm saying that the law has proven that you can't make a one-size-fits-all. Let me talk to you about solutions and what you would propose, because you are a fountain of wisdom and have always seen through the governmental bureaucracy to what really will work. One thing I'm going to throw out there is the company that hired this green card holder must not have taken the time to evaluate his own personal morality, because it was a moral issue for him to plow into cars. I mean, think about this with me for a minute, Tom. There are four people dead. There are other people in the hospital. Why is that true? It's because it said in all the news reports he closed his eyes right before, when he realized he's going to have an accident, he closed his eyes. I mean, would it not have been better for him to have driven off the highway and avoid the other passenger cars?
Depending on where he was at, that may have not been a availability to him. But I've been following all kinds of different media sources on this, and supposedly this gentleman does not know what an emergency escape ramp is for, which is part of your training. If he lost his brakes, there is an emergency escape ramp, and you can see these down in Arkansas, where it, while you're going down the hill, they have created a ramp that goes up the hill, and it starts out pavement, and then it goes to like 6 inches of sand, 8 inches of sand, 10 inches of sand, 12 inches of sand, and just keeps getting thicker and thicker in the sand. So it will slow and stop that truck before it gets to the top of the runway ramp. And he's stuck there. He's not going to go anywhere. He's buried in sand. So it takes a tow truck to get him back out of there. But these are things that not a lot of people are instructed on how to use, when to use, why to use. And most people don't think. I mean, I don't know what I would do if I was in that scenario. Yeah, I would probably take an off-ramp. But then if you take an off-ramp, you don't have any brakes. Number one, I would not allow myself to not have any brakes, period. And according to some DOT sources, this trucking company has had brake violations with their equipment prior to this. You as the driver are responsible for the equipment that you operate. If you feel that it is unsafe, you should say, no, I'm not going to drive that. You do have those protections within the confines of law that a company cannot just fire you simply because you refuse to drive an unsafe piece of equipment. Was his equipment unsafe? I don't know. I haven't seen a report that says yes. I have not received a report that says it was okay.
Well, what would happen if we simply started by having the police enforce the laws we already have on the books, such as following too closely? What if truck drivers started getting pulled over and passenger cars when they don't give enough space for each other to stop? I mean, like any law, and you've seen the legislature plenty of times in action, so you can back me up on this. Every time there's a tragedy, people say, oh, we need to pass a new law, as if the person was killed for lack of laws, which is, of course, not true. It's not lack of laws, but we're so fast to quickly try and pass a new law. I'm saying enforce what we already have on the books. Why are there trucks that bypass the scales?
Because there are, if you are paying attention as you come up on the scale, you will see what is in effect. There is a scale in the road. So while you are in motion, there is an electronic sensor that hangs up there where that scale is on the road. So as you drive across that scale, it weighs out your axles and it sends that information to the scale house. There's a company, there's several, but I'm familiar with Bypass, Pike Pass is for the interstate. I can't think of the one for the scale house that we used to have at Prime. But basically Prime, when I was there, would submit all of its information to the third party company that had this little transponder in my truck. So when my truck went through and underneath that transponder reader that was on the highway and it went across the scale, if there was nothing wrong with any of the permitting or anything related to Prime at the time, I would get a green light, which allowed me to continue right past the scale because they already have me logged in as going down that highway. And in today's logbook world, or actually before the ELD, you would have to match that green light to within an hour in your logbook in order for you to be legal.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. In all the stories I've read, it seems like the driver's the one on the hook, as should be. But do you believe that the company should also bear some culpability?
Well, right now, the way it is with the electronic logging device, I have been informed if somebody decides to shut it off and continue to drive, not only is the driver fined, but the company is fined as well.
Yeah. So tell me, what are your ideas? If you were in the legislature, what would you want to see changed to make our roads safer for everybody?
I think in all sincerity, in order to make the highway safe for everybody, there needs to be a dedicated lane. And I know that if anyone's listening from MoDOT, they're going to be pulling their hair out. You know, they restrict truck traffic to the right two lanes. Well, if you think about this, everyone getting on and everyone getting off are getting into one of those two right-hand lanes. So you've created a bottleneck where the truck driver is you created a scenario where it has become unsafe for them to be there simply because the volume of cars getting on and off the highway. Create a dedicated lane for those that are just going straight through the city to get in that lane and go straight through the city. No exits, no off-ramps, no on-ramps. You get in on one end, you go the whole way through, and you're off. It puts trucks and trucks and trucks and trucks and trucks and trucks together. So granted, if somebody wants to do 65 mile an hour, then everyone is going to be doing 65 mile an hour. But it gets the trucks out of the right two lanes where there's nothing but thousands upon thousands of cars are getting on and getting off, getting on and getting off. And it has become a continuous stop and go, stop and go, stop and go. And part of the problem is because the cars getting on and off don't know how to merge, refuse to look prior to getting on or off, which creates part of this problem. And yes, there are truck drivers that do the same identical thing. Dedicated lanes would be great. You know, I used to drive at night. I predominantly drove at night simply because there was less traffic. There were less police on the highway. There was less of the availability of for me to get involved in an accident simply because there was nobody out there.
You're making a lot of sense, Tom. I have to admit, there have been many, many times when I've been driving in the right lane on a highway, because that's the driving lane. You're supposed to save the left lane for a passing lane. Hoo-hoo! Newsflash! And there have been cars trying to come on and off the highway, merging on. And I always tell my family members, the stock answer from MoDOT is the vehicular traffic already on the highway does not need to adjust our speed. It's the duty of the person on the ramp trying to merge onto the highway to adjust their speed to accommodate the speed of the vehicles on the highway, not the other way around. And yet I get reminded, yeah, but if I don't slow up or speed up or slow down, we're going to have an accident. And that's true. People, you're right. When they're merging on, they can't even think. It's like they are oblivious. Now, I learned how to drive in Boston, Massachusetts, which is a complete different tone. You have to have a fully different mentality to be able to drive in Boston. That's where defensive driving originated from. I come to Missouri, and it's like everybody's in that cartoon we used to watch when we were little kids where everyone is in a trance, and so they drive like they're in a trance, really like they can't think of anything else, but they're going nice and slow, and so you can maneuver around them. There is definitely an attitude that people have in different cities as they're driving, but the only attitude that really matters is respect for the other motorists on the road, to be gentle and kind and realize we're all sharing the road together. So give me your best piece of advice. What do you think would be the single most effective way to make the road safer for everybody?
One of the things that I see as a huge failure, it's in the trucking industry, it's also in the car industry, is people, I don't know how to describe it. I'm going to say they don't drive beyond the hood of their car. They become entranced on what's immediately in front of them instead of looking down the road. And to give a good example, as you're coming down I-44, so most of the overpasses, as you're coming up to them, you can see traffic going back and forth on that overpass, which also means that you can see an individual who is turning to come down the on-ramp, which means this person is going to be merging into the right-hand lane. It behooves you at that point as a driver to make sure that there's nobody to your left, because you're doing 70, 75 mile an hour, depending on what state you're in, 80 in some states. If you can move to the left safely and continue to travel, because by the time you get up to the end of that on-ramp, guess who's going to be there? It's going to be the individual who you just saw going across that bridge. People don't think. They don't think about what's most effective for them. I've had it where somebody is coming up beside me. I can see the cop car way up there, so I know I have to get over in the left-hand lane, or I should, because that's the most safest thing to do, and I'll explain why here momentarily. This individual, who my truck is governed at 72 mile an hour, well, he comes up beside me doing about 72.11, so it's going to take him forever to get around me. Instead of them speeding up, they now slow down to match my speed, which means I can't get over in the left-hand lane. What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to slow down. How about that individual who's in the left-hand lane pay attention to what's going on up in front of them so they can see the cop car. They know that I'm supposed to get over. Get out of my way.
Mm-hmm.
Speed up. Get in front of me. Allow me to come to the left, because I want to give that officer, I want to give that tow truck operator, I want to give that broke down vehicle all the room I possibly can. And here's why. Early in my driving career, we're coming across Nebraska. At that point in time, Nebraska was a 75 mile an hour state, and there was probably four or five of us that were doing about 76, 77 mile an hour. The cars in the left-hand lane are probably doing about 80, 85, and they have gotten themselves grouped together where there's about 3 or 4 foot off of the bumpers as they're coming through.
Terrible.
I'm truck number two in line, and the guy in front of me tells me on the radio that there's a broke-down four-wheeler up ahead of us on the shoulder with its four ways on. So we all put our left-hand turn signals on to get over, but there's so much traffic coming up on the left, and nobody wants to get behind a truck, so they have effectively blocked us all into the right-hand lane. The broke-down four-wheeler was an individual who wanted to commit suicide.
Mm.
So the broke-down four-wheeler, when the five of us came up on him, opened the door and ran out in front of truck one.
Oh, no.
That guy did not even have time to get on the radio to tell me that I'm getting ready to run over top of a body. I kept in contact with that guy for 3 years until he committed suicide.
Oh, no.
The fact that somebody decided to do suicide by truck driver ate that guy internally to the point where he could no longer handle it. He stopped driving. He could not drive anymore. If he needed to go someplace, he always had somebody else drive him. At first, I thought he was doing really well, but you could tell the longer it went, you know, this was thing, and the parents of the individual actually sued the trucking company that he worked for and sued him individually, because we didn't get out of the right-hand lane to the left-hand lane to prevent that scenario. So it just ate him more and more and more. And in about, I think it was close to 3 years, he committed suicide. He left behind a wife and two kids.
Oh, no.
All because one individual did not want to continue on with their life. And instead of them doing it in a manner or seeking counseling or doing whatever it is that they wanted to do, they decided to step out in front of a semi that's doing 75 mile an hour on a 75 mile an hour posted speed limit in a state that it's just flat.
Wow. And
that is why I make every attempt available to me to always get in that left-hand lane, no matter what the vehicle is up in front of me. I don't care if it has an orange sticker on there and that car has been there for a week and a half. I don't trust it.
Mm. So do you like the move over laws?
I don't think they need to be laws, because I tell you what we've done. We've created a we've created a specialty class of people.
Mm-hmm.
You have to move over for cops. You have to move over for fire officials. You have to move over for MODOC, emergency vehicles. What about the average Joe that has a flat tire? Is he not special enough for a law to be created to have traffic move over for them?
Well, I was driving down the highway once, and there was a police car that was not fully out of the lane of traffic. And the move over law doesn't say you have to move over. You have to slow down if it's not okay to move over.
Correct.
But the police officer was standing in the lane of traffic, and I was very worried for him because I thought, you know, he's really presuming on everybody being able to move over, which is not always the case. Sometimes you, like you described, sometimes you cannot get into the left lane. And for him to be so lackadaisical about it, they still have some obligation to try and protect themselves a little bit, you'd think.
Well, you would think, because the availability of, I mean, he could have ended up to the point where somebody hit him, not intending
right
to hit them.
But the move over law had lulled him into, the move over law had lulled him into thinking that that whole lane is safe and available now that he can stand in it. And it scared me for his safety's sake.
Yeah, because it's almost like he's an individual challenges the vehicles coming at them. And it's also up to the officer's discretion on whether or not you slow down enough.
Enough, right. That's always a bad law when it's not specific on what does that mean. And there's no way you can legislate enough, because then you'd have to have somebody with a radar gun when he's supposed to be taking care of an emergency, not shooting radar. So there definitely are a lot of concerns. But the most important thing is that we not quickly rush to pass new laws when we don't know what we're doing, just to assuage the public opinion. I remember when I was in the House of Representatives, there was a baby who died in a daycare, and the mom and grandmother were so grieved over it, they wanted to pass a law to make sure that the judge would never be able to have the freedom and latitude that he exercised in this case. And I didn't feel it was a correct use of the legislature to try and make a new law just because they were grieving over the loss of a baby. Now, having a baby die is a terrible thing, but there'd been no adjudication and we didn't know enough facts. And I remember the pressure I was under to have a hearing on a law that was, in my opinion, a total waste of time, because all that's going to do is make the committee members cry. The harmed family is going to come to the legislature, tell their story, hold up a picture of the baby, make everybody feel bad, and then they top it off with, now, don't you think we should have a law so this doesn't ever happen to anyone else? Ha! There's no such thing as a law where nobody else will get hurt ever again. And then the legislature passed a law, and everybody was safe ever after, and nobody ever got hurt. Isn't that wonderful?
Well, but at least the individual would have had the law named after their baby.
Yep, there you go. So, Tom, before I let you get away, can you comment on what's the most ridiculous law you've seen go through the legislature so far this year?
Well, you know where I stand on the prescription drug monitoring programs.
And that is that's a perfect example of how if there's a bad idea and you vote no on it, it will come back again repeatedly until they get enough people to vote yes on it. They're just waiting for the next group of legislators so that it can really pass next time. And bad ideas don't usually go away. I have no idea what is in the brains of the legislature that they think that this is going to solve anything. I voted back when I was in the House. We were had the prescription drug monitoring program bill come up repeatedly. And I remember sitting at my desk. It was when it was still a new idea. This is going back more than 10 years ago. How I dealt with it, I thought about my brother who was addicted to drugs. My first thought was, oh, that would be something that may have helped him. You know what? There was another representative sitting in front of me, and there's a lot of coaching that goes on the House floor. Not ahead of time, but when they ring the bell and the legislators start voting, that's when a lot of them start to figure out what's in the bill and if they should support it or not. And so frequently they'll ask their friends. And it was a representative sitting in front of me who said, it's just too much Big Brother. It's like going into a dressing room and I tried it on and it made me look fat and I can't do it. It's just too much government. And I loved him telling me that because I needed to know what is at stake and how. Why would any legislator, and I know the woman promoting it is going around telling that she had a child who was addicted to drugs and that's why we need this bill. Does she really think that people should pass a law just for her own daughter? We're going to affect the whole state just for one girl, one person? No, that's not how you make good laws. So, yeah, I do have an opinion on this prescription drug monitoring program. I cannot believe that the legislators are so stupid. I hate to even talk that way, but especially the story I heard of Jeannie Riddle, because she was in the House when I was in the House. And the story I heard is that she voted yes to get it out of committee, but she did a wink, wink to her constituents and said, don't worry, I'll vote no when it comes to the House floor. Well, do they think that we can't figure out that when you vote yes to get it out of committee, you are supporting the bill? Do they think we're that stupid that when something goes to the House floor, they can vote no and we won't know what's really going on?
See, even if you listen to Representative Reeder's story, a prescription drug monitoring program would not have stopped her daughter from getting addicted to drugs. Because if I'm not mistaken, she was on the local 1260 KSGF down here with Nick Reed, and she made the comment that something happened to her daughter. She was prescribed pain meds. She ran out, and then she had a friend give her some drugs that she had that were painkillers. The prescription drug monitoring program does not stop that.
No, it doesn't.
And I'm sorry, every Friday morning from 7 to 8, I do a local radio station down, the local radio show here down in Springfield with, I believe in my heart, the most intelligent man I have ever met when it comes to this prescription drug monitoring program by the name of Dr. John Lilly. And he knows this program inside out, backwards, upside down, any way you can possibly think of. He goes up to Jefferson City to testify, and he is grilled simply by giving them facts and information based on what it is that has transpired in the other 49 states that have this program, that it does not work. The first thing they did this year was they put that bill in committee, they rushed it through committee, they got it to the floor, they got it voted on, and they shipped it to the Senate. That was the first bill. HB 188 was the first bill to pass out of the House this year.
Knowing that it won't make the world a better place, what is the driving force behind it? There's got to be more than just this pie in the sky idea that if we pass this bill, people won't be addicted to drugs ever again.
Well, it all comes down to a national database on who is and who is not on a prescription, which then leads into the red flag laws.
None of their business. Tom, I can't I can't even buy pseudoephedrine or Sudafed anymore because they thought that it would stop people from making methamphetamine. Is that the true story now? The narrative goes that people used to have methamphetamine, and now that we stopped letting people buy pseudoephedrine, nobody's addicted to meth anymore.
Well, they're saying the same thing about fentanyl. The only problem is fentanyl's coming up from Mexico, and it's coming across from China. So, an addict is going to get whatever it is that they're addicted to, or they're going to find a different mechanism to have the same feeling until they themselves decide that they no longer want to be an addict.
My point is, I can't believe the people who are smart enough to get elected to office would be so easily duped by one sad story. And I don't believe it is a sad story. I think that it's a story, but I don't think it relates to why we need to change the database for the whole state of Missouri now because of that. So I'm really grieved as well. I think it's shocking that they could not be smarter than this. Why is it that all the smart people don't seem to be able to get elected?
Because they are ridiculed and they're demeaned because they believe that it is every individual's liberty and right to be left alone. You know, they always say that there's no I in team. Well, guess what is dead center of the term society?
I. So are people going to help John Lilly get elected?
I don't think John wants to be a state rep. I don't think John wants to be a state senator. I mean, he did serve on the school board out in Willard for a couple of terms. And he even makes the case that he wishes he would have known the Constitution better, especially the state Constitution better, when he served on the Willard School Board, because there would have been things that he would have done differently. And I think there's an application, and I'm going to put people who understand and adhere to the Constitution in a small, minuscule minority, because right now we have an individual in the name of Mike Moon who will raise that Constitution up and say, hey, in Article 3, Section whatever, or Article 5, Section whatever, Article 1, Section whatever, this bill is in violation of. And they're like, well, you don't know. A judge hasn't determined. You know, when you swore that oath, no one said anything about a judge. You swore the oath that you would support and adhere to the Constitution. So that means that you have to have a knowledge for it. And you should not be allowing anything that you think is unconstitutional to even make it out of your chamber to the next chamber to make it to the governor's desk.
You know, I've been out of office for a number of years, and I even have had many times when I've thought of how I would do things differently if I could do it again. So there is a growing up process, and my only hope is that the legislature will grow up and learn. But unfortunately, with term limits, by the time people get enlightened, they have to move on. Do you have an opinion
I am adamantly opposed to term limits.
Good going, Tom.
The fact that we get rid of people simply because they served 8 years and then we allow them another 8 years to serve in the Senate should they decide to is absolutely ludicrous. Every 2 years or every 4 years or every 6 years, depending on what the term is, we have term limits.
Exactly.
Vote them out.
Tom, you are so right. And the problem that precipitated term limits to begin with was the idea that I don't like a certain rep, so if we have term limits, they'll automatically leave. Well, guess what? When a bad person leaves, there's about 100% chance that they'll be replaced with another bad person. And when a good person has to leave due to term limits, you still have about a 50% chance that they'll be replaced by a bad person. And so I don't think it's created a net gain for anyone. Yeah, it did get some old fogies out of there, but what they're being replaced with is not much to write home about either. So plus, they're not only are we getting rid of some people who finally figured out what they're doing, but when they leave, even if they are replaced by a good person, it's going to take the good person a while to learn the ropes and to get up to speed. And then you have a 50% chance that that good person will turn into a bad person. So what have we accomplished?
Well, part of the problem is we ignore, from the very beginning, we ignore the local level politic body.
Mm-hmm.
So you automatically have, you know, and I refer to them as nanny statist. Well, we're the government. We have to control you. We're the government. We need to give you permission. We're the government. Without us, you wouldn't be able to do anything. We elect those people on a local level. They're our neighbors, for Pete's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's at that point that you should have said, whoa, wait a minute. This isn't the same person that I live beside. This isn't the way he talked or she talked prior to getting elected. They were all, you know, Guns and Roses and, you know, liberty. That's why now unless somebody has what I call Liberty Street credibility, which means they have done something outside of their job in the private sector to bring government to a halt in some manner, there is no way I'm going to vote for them. Too many people use the word liberty. Too many people use the word constitution. Too many people use the word freedom, you know, land of the free, home of the brave, but yet they have the slightest clue of what it means.
And yet the media does tend to have a big hand in who wins and loses, especially on the higher level races. And it does sadden me that when you have media forces that come against a good person, they have that much credibility and that much opportunity to trash good people. I do feel bad about that.
Yeah, well, right now there are, you know, in getting back to this trucking thing and this accident, we've got people right now who are making assumptions and creating a narrative that they don't even know if it exists within this, you know, within this accident. But we're ready to jump on any little thing that we can get a hold of before we have all the facts to back us up. And I'm going to blame media on that too, because very rarely do they supply facts at the very beginning. They supply innuendo, which some people believe is fact, and then they'll start promoting it as fact. And then the next thing you know, the story gets so far out of whack that you can't tell what is factual and what was made up within 3 days of it being released.
And that's why dash cams are so important. If it weren't for dash cams, we wouldn't be able to protect ourselves when people try and make it sound like something else happened. And so, I mean, the fact that we're able to record things is making a huge difference in creating some accountability. Even with the police officers wearing body cameras, it in some cases, it has allowed us to see what we need to see. I think about that young man who was being harassed by the Native American over in Washington, D.C. at the March for Life. And if it hadn't been for all the people who whipped out their cell phones and recorded it, they tried to make that boy seem like he was the aggressor. And thankfully, there was some truth that was able to come out. And so I am optimistic that we have ways to continue to get truth out. So what are you optimistic about, Tom?
Well, you know, one of the things I was talking to an individual today that, you know, I've been there's several trucking groups that I belong to. And one of the individuals had called me today because I had posted something in the group about when you do these, I think they're called vlogs, video log things. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be aware that your message, even though you only think it's getting out to the people that you want it to get out to, goes beyond your core group. So what you do while you're doing this vlog has a lot to do with, you know, your mannerisms. Don't sit there and smoke a cigarette while you're discussing something within the trucking industry, or sit there and have a beer, or, you know, sit there with a button down shirt and your big old hairy chest sticking out. That if you're trying to promote a professional message, the first thing you have to do is to look and act professional. Because that message that you're putting out on the internet, you have no clue who's viewing it at any given point in time of day.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. You're right. We all have our duty to communicate. We all have a different message. You've got a great message. And I thank you for giving me a few minutes out of your very busy day to share some insights and give us a whole nother angle on what's going on with the truck driving profession. So is there one last thing you want to tell us, Tom, that you want us to all remember?
Well, learning how to drive and training how to drive is two different things.
Yep.
Are you aware of your surroundings? And here's a safety tip that people don't think about. Every Friday when I'm on the air, if it's raining, I'll do a public service announcement and tell people to turn their headlights on. And it's not so that you can see. It's so that you can be seen. You'd be surprised how many times somebody comes up to pass you, whether it be on the left or right, makes no difference, that you do not see this individual in the mirror of these semis.
Mm-hmm.
Because the spray off of the trailer tires, if that car is a close color to the pavement or the concrete, you completely lose that vehicle in your mirror. You don't even know it's there until they're about halfway up the trailer. If they had their headlights on, you could see them prior to them getting up to the point where if you wanted to change lanes, and I've seen it happen. A car goes up to pass a truck. He didn't have his headlights on. The truck, you know, put his turn signal on and moved over. He had the slightest clue that that car was even there. Safety should be embedded in our training, whether it be in a car, motorcycle, or truck. Sadly, it is quite lacking on every single level.
So thank you for giving us that good word. We are all enriched and enlightened by your talk with us. So thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia, and have a good evening.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week, and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.